Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The basis of sovereignty is a tribe's control over its own land. But tribes also have a stake in what happens in the skies over that land. And the laws about that are not as clear-cut. Drones equipped with high-resolution cameras are becoming more commonplace, creating pressure to solidify what activities are and are not allowed. Some tribes are enacting protections, but there have been few tests of those laws. We'll learn more about protecting tribal airspace after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Chickasaw Nation is pooling resources to aid the cities of Sulphur and Marietta, Oklahoma, in the aftermath of a recent fatal storm system that ravaged both communities. First responders and Chickasaw Nation Light Horse Police have been on site assisting with search and rescue efforts, assessing damage, and aiding in unsafe areas. In a statement, Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby said their hearts go out to all the individuals and families affected by this tragic and destructive storm. He added they're actively collaborating with local authorities and emergency management agencies in relief efforts and will be there to assist our employees, neighbors, and friends. The storm system caused 4 fatalities in Oklahoma in late April, 2 being in the Chickasaw Nation. Hundreds of people who were also injured throughout the state and hundreds of homes and businesses were damaged. As high school and college students plan for their graduations, some Native students could face resistance for wanting to wear tribal regalia with their caps and gowns. The Mountain West Newsboro's Caleb Radle has more.
For Native communities, an eagle feather is a symbol of wisdom and strength, and given in times of great honor, like a graduation. But every spring, the Native American Rights Fund hears from students who were not allowed to wear an eagle feather or other tribal regalia. Morgan Saunders is an attorney with the Colorado-based law group. She says parents often break down in tears when they discuss their child being denied their tribal identity.
For many families, the wearing of the eagle feather is more important than the diploma because it's something that's given at this important time in their child's life. They're transitioning, you know, often into adulthood.
More than a dozen states have laws to protect a Native student's right to wear tribal regalia, including Nevada, Colorado, and Utah. Saunders says families in states without those protections should review their school district's policies and request dress code accommodations as early as possible. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radle.
On Monday, Speaker Robert Rivas called upon Assemblymember James C. Ramos to deliver the first land acknowledgement to recognize area tribes on those lands the state capitol stands prior to opening of the Assembly floor session at the California session. Ramos says he was moved by the speaker's request to perform a land acknowledgement. He says tribes have always populated this state and had no boundaries and resided on their long-held homelands until Europeans and settlers immigrated to what is now known as California. He goes on to acknowledge the first healing between the state and tribes. Assemblymember James C. Ramos proudly represents the 45th Assembly District. He is the first and only California Native American serving in the state's legislature. I'm Jill Freitas.
We'll be right back. National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Tribes can enact laws that manage their lands and waters. But what about the sky above their land? The policies and laws about that are less clear. The current popularity of unmanned aircraft like drones and the potential for remote deliveries and other services means the airspace above tribal lands could become much more congested. Today we talk with people who put some thought into the implication for tribes and their control of their own airspace. We also want to hear from you. Is your community looking to regulate the sky? Do you have drones or unwanted air traffic over your tribal lands? Let us know. Join us with comments and questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That number is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And you can also leave a comment on our website or social media pages. We've got Facebook, we've got Instagram, so connect with us through social media as well. Joining us now from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan in Canada is Jacob Taylor. He is the CEO of Indigenous Aerospace, and he's from Curve Lake First Nation. Good morning, Jacob, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Good morning, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here with you again.
You bet. Joining us from Sioux Valley, Manitoba in Canada is Elton Taylor. He's no relation to Jacob, though. He is the communications coordinator for the Sioux Valley Dakota Nation, and he's also a Sioux Valley Dakota Nation band member. Hello, Elton, and welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning to you. Joining us from Missoula, Montana is Jonathan Cordova. He is a geography student at the University of Montana. Jonathan, hello, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sean. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And joining us now from Rochester, New York, we have Shelley Knight. Shelley is a cyber infrastructure facilitator at the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. And a note of disclosure, AHEC is an underwriter for our show, Native America Calling. Hello, Shelley, and welcome to our show.
Hi, Sean. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have all of you on the line here. And Jacob, I'm going to start with you today. You were on our show not very long ago, just about a month and a half ago, talking about how Native people and tribes are using drones. But there's this ancillary discussion with regard to the ability of tribes to control or limit their airspace from outside drones and maybe other remote devices too. What's the key takeaway there for our listeners?
For me, I believe the sky is unceded. And treaties were being signed, air traffic, air vehicles were unimaginable to the human mind. And so when our negotiations with settler governments were going on and agreements of treaty were formed, we, you know, apparently ceded the land, and many water walkers today say the water was not a part of that, but, you know, the treaty commissioners and stuff traveled by canoe, and so that was a modality of transportation of the day, but certainly aircraft was not. And so how could we have given up our inherent rights to regulate and participate in that space, given it was not something of the day?
Well, what first turned you on to the whole concept of tribal sovereignty extending over the skies?
Yeah, so, working in drone technology development is one area, and seeing the emergent regulations and the fees and things that are coming forward, and, the gaps that are available for First Nations to develop their own regulations outside of just banning drone activity. It was one area. And then another, you know, being originally from Ontario, Curve Lake First Nation, right between Ottawa, Ontario, our national capital, and Toronto, Ontario, our provincial capital and sort of economic center and largest population center in the country. It was also developers buying air rights to help their condos have, you know, unencumbered views of the horizon or to plan for future developments, or even seeing like the city of Ottawa selling the airspace above municipal buildings, you know, for developers to build on, but keeping their ground level buildings there and sort of subsidizing city activities. So this all became a fascinating thing to me of like, wait, you know, these regulations are developing and communities are kind of on the margins of the regulatory development. And at the same time, all these other folks are selling and making money off something that, again, I believe we never ceded to them as a right to sell and make profit from. And then related to, you know, drones and airspace is airspace navigation fees. So as other, you know, countries come into our domestic airspace, there's certain fees that they pay both, you know, in Canada and the U.S. I think in the U.S. it's like $26 U.S. per 100 nautical miles. You know, and even looking at that, you can see with your major metropolises like New York City, I think they're selling air rights for 200 or air parcels, perhaps the developers use the language of, to treat it more akin to land. And then with all of that discussion, we're seeing like taxation coming in and governments wondering, you know, how they get their piece of this pie. And so this is a really exciting kind of area that I think is really muddy water in all sorts of jurisdictions. And so it's an important time to have the conversation, or maybe cloudy skies we should use, right?
There you go.
So that's kind of what my interest is, multifaceted in it.
Okay. Yeah. Pun intended. Well, yeah. And I like that analogy, cloudy skies, because Jacob, myself, and I think a lot of our listeners were kind of confused because on one hand, like this sounds really exciting, the way this idea of, you know, having packages delivered by drone to your front door and like medical supplies. But at the same time, it also sounds like, geez, you know, do I want all these little devices flying over my house every day and in my community? And I mean, what do you think the future holds in terms of just how this is going to impact just communities, native families, native people with the skies potentially being so congested?
Yeah, it is an interesting thing, right? With drones flying kind of at that like building height level, 400 feet, as most, you know, large infrastructure, especially in a community context, would possibly reach to. And so it's a crucial time to have that conversation. And there's many different voices about it. Some people are, you know, really supportive, other people not so much. And so there's such a amount of misinformation and confusion that we really need to come together, have the conversation and set some clear boundaries, you know, that respect both aerospace regulations, public concerns with development and government concern with development, as well as tribal sovereignty and individual privacy. So there's a lot of conversation going on that needs to have that intersects so many areas of our society. And I think it's a crucial time to have this conversation, you know, especially with the international UNDRIP being adopted in so many countries and so many different locations, which, you know, purports to support self-determination of indigenous populations. And so with this sort of new area of development, you know, low-flying aircraft that went by the name of drones, this brings up a crucial time for us to have it. And yeah, there's so many confluences coming together that now is the time for this. So it's a great time to have this show and spark interest in the young people and the people who work in these spheres to come together and put our minds together.
Well, Jacob, you mentioned earlier that as tribal nations, we never ceded the skies. So what is your ideal concept for how tribes could potentially exercise their sovereignty with regard to the skies? I'm curious.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this still needs to come together with a lot of people before. But right now, my position is like there's a lot of jobs in aerospace, you know, navigation, whether that's, you know, surveillance, air traffic management, et cetera. What are we doing to include First Peoples in those occupations and helping with that? Also, you know, there's much money made, like I said, on airspace navigation fees, the selling of air rights, et cetera. Where is our economic participation in those transfers, in those transactions? And, you know, then the third piece is our governance. Where's our opportunity to come in with our own self-determined ideas on how aircraft can move in and out of our airspace? And then coming a little bit further, how do we define our airspace? We all have reserve reservation land, but we also have traditional territory, you know, adjacent to that land. And how far does this all go? And truly, if it is the unceded position that I take, then it is, you know, transnational. It's all the way across the continent for us to work together on. And so, some sort of Turtle Island Aeronautic Association where we eliminate that medicine line that, the colonial governments created, and we start working together as the people of Turtle Island.
Well, here, you know, in the States, we've got the Federal Aviation Administration. We've also got the military, the Air Force. I mean, how do all of these, you know, governmental bodies and regulators, how would that all work potentially with tribes involved in that mix?
Yeah, you know, most of the time our history with the colonial government is they don't want us involved in anything with power, and especially political power decision making. And when we start to involve those groups, because they have international affairs, this can also become a complicated effort as, you know, airspace and navigable airspace become parts of discussions with other countries. A flight from, say, Amsterdam over to Taipei could go over the Chinese airspace, but the flight leaving Taipei would probably go around the Chinese airspace to get back to Amsterdam. So just to give a context, like as a military and political, you know, the major power of the U.S. government and the little sister government that we have here in Canada, these have like international consequences. And, you know, again, they typically have not wanted us in there, which is why we as the people have, you know, the decolonial conversation with them, like transfer some of that power back. But it is certainly a really complicated conversation and needs to, you know, while history may have not considered this and it is unceded, we still have a lot of, serious military and political considerations to think mm-hmm. about when we start to devolve power to other parties.
A complicated conversation, an interesting conversation, and a conversation that is going to continue when we come back from this short break. Dene Jingle Dress Dancer and business owner Cassie John is the new Miss Indian World. She was just crowned at the latest Gathering of Nations powwow and joins a sisterhood of other Native cultural ambassadors. As an artist, she's an advocate for digital storytelling and is eager to introduce herself to you. That's on the next episode of Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are talking with researchers and experts about the sky and the limits of tribal sovereignty. What are your thoughts on tribes regulating their airspace? Should the same laws of sovereignty that apply to tribal lands also apply to the skies? Join the conversation with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. Would really love to get some listener feedback on this show today. Hear your thoughts, hear your ideas, hear your perspectives. The number again, 1-800-996-2848. Our next guest, Elton Taylor, is the communications coordinator for the Sioux Valley Dakota Nation in Manitoba, Canada. And Elton, have there been issues with control of airspace over the Sioux Valley Dakota Nation that you can share with us?
All right. Good morning. We've actually had several scenarios over the years, but I'll break down a little bit of my background here. I'm Sioux Valley Dakota Nation member up in Sioux Valley, Manitoba, Canada. We have a tripartite self-government agreement with the province as well as the country. So much like in the U.S., it's a state and then federal. We have a provincial and then federal. So we do have a little more pull in regards to some of our issues, such as education and our land sovereignty and things like that. But one of the issues we have is that Sioux Valley is situated 55 kilometers outside of the second largest city in Manitoba. And we are also located approximately 65, 70 kilometers outside of a military base as well. So we constantly have issues with flights flying over top coming in for landing in Brandon. We have military exercises and military flights that fly overhead in our airspace. We are out in the middle of the country, so we also have crop dusters that do fly in the area, dropping oftentimes chemicals that we don't want in our land. And then, of course, there is the drone issue, which is a more recent issue. I'll share a story that we recently encountered this past year that kind of made us realize that these drones could potentially be an issue in our airspace, and that is we have a Sioux Valley member who made it to the NHL by the name of Zach Whitecloud, and he played with the Las Vegas Golden Knights. He's still with them. And as many of you are aware, the Golden Knights won the Stanley Cup last year. So he had the opportunity to bring the Stanley Cup to Sioux Valley Dakota Nation. And not often do you get to have an opportunity where the Stanley Cup is in your home community, never mind it being a reserve. So in that process, there was numerous media outlets that had come out. There were several other visitors from other communities wanting to come out and celebrate the day with us. And unfortunately, we do have our own drone department where we have several pilots who can fly the drones and they help us out with aerial images, surveying, things like that. But on this day, there was also additional media drones. There was fan drones. And there was nothing regulating who was flying, whether they were flying safely, whether they had any right to be flying in our airspace. And at the end of the day, it was kind of a downer because some of our shots we couldn't get because of the amount of drone traffic that was over top of our park, risking several accidents or potential damage to not only their drones, but our drones. And as many of you know, yes, drones have come down in cost, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's a price that we want to pay and damage our own drones. So we have to sacrifice some of our own work and our own shots for the safety of everybody that was on the ground. And of course, we have an NHL player there, and we don't want to risk him getting injured or any of the other media members there and turning it into something that just gets out of hand. So we opted to take the safe route and fly a little bit higher, a little bit back, and kind of maintain that safety. But at the end of the day, we do need some kind of regulations that would essentially be either our drones and nobody else, or you apply for permits, you work with the other pilots, and you find a safe space where all of you can work together and fly safely. So those are some of the issues that we do deal with within Sioux Valley Dakota Nation, and some of them, like I said, more recently with the drones.
Okay. Well, what you described there, and I'm a hockey fan, so I know exactly who Zach Whitecloud is and the Golden Knights winning the Stanley Cup last year. So that's super exciting, that story. But it describes what I talked about earlier, just this confusion and like just this chaos in the skies. And I think that's what a lot of people are concerned about. Elton, we heard Jacob talk earlier about his vision for how tribes can exercise potentially their sovereignty regarding the sky. How would your tribal nation, what's your vision in terms of how you folks can control those skies as well?
Well, just on a local basis, like I said, we have a tripartite self-governance agreement. So we do have some freedoms in there, but even at the time of us signing into self-government, I don't think we really envisioned, and keep in mind, this is just a decade ago, I don't think we really truly envisioned overseeing the skies above us. I mean, we thought about the ground, we thought about the ground beneath us, and we thought about our space that we're living in, but it never fully dawned on us to include the sky above us as part of that agreement. And like Jacob had said earlier, we're talking about treaties that go back hundreds of years. And in many cases, absolutely, we were not flying. We were not considering the airspace above our heads. And that's something that we really should be taking a better look at, and not only just within the national or the local international area, U.S. and Canada. We need to start considering international things. Water is a great example of it. There is international laws that apply to water. I believe we could look at potentially looking at international laws in regards to the skies and having some local control and some local representation be a part of that community.
I feel like in some ways we might be really behind the curve here, because as you mentioned, even just 10 years ago, people weren't imagining this potential scenario. And now, I mean, are we really having to play catch up here with regard to how we exercise control over the skies? I mean, some people might listen to the show and say, well, geez, you know, this horse is already, it's already left the gate here. How are tribes going to catch up and take control of these skies when, you know, there's so many forces right now that are vying to have this control with drones and other types of aircraft?
I do believe we are playing a little bit of catch up, but sometimes playing catch up works in your benefit because you can avoid a lot of the hurdles that others have had to face. In my previous profession, which is still with Sioux Valley Dakota Nation, I was always also a network administrator for our school. So I dealt with our IT department and worked with internet and security and all those things. Coming late to the game as far as internet and data management, it helped us to leap over 15, 20 years of data and things that were being built and laws that were being built, and we were able to jump into the mix and catch up really quick as far as data sovereignty goes. So taking control of our domain names, taking control of our databases, taking control of our information, and then ultimately controlling how it is we are going to digitally manage our networks and Sioux Valley Dakota Nation's information. And I believe something like that also applies to things like drones. We weren't there to deal with the early drones, which were very big, bulky. It was, you know, unceded area in the sky, not only for us, but for the rest of Canada. We didn't start enacting any real major laws as far as drones go until about 2017. And prior to that, everything dealt with helicopters and planes. And so we're not too far behind in the game, but I believe we can avoid a lot of those early hurdles because we are a step late to the game, so to speak.
All right. And Elton, Sioux Valley Dakota Nation also has a drone department. Tell us more about it.
Yes, we do. We started off with a few. This is something we originally envisioned back in 2017, and there was only a couple of us that were interested. We did have some flooding issues in our area, and then we did have some land boundary issues, and we wanted to be able to survey them. But hiring a company to come in and do surveys and do drones was rather expensive at the time. So we had opted to, you know, train a couple of our staff, our band members, and get them to start flying drones and get some of these aerial images and start working on those things. And just when we bought our drone and we started getting out and started flying, that's when Canada decided to enact some laws. So we kind of threw it on the back burner for a little while and then waited to see how Canada was going to settle the drone laws and the drone classifications, because as we're all aware, there's different sizes, different types, different weights. And we knew eventually they're going to start classifying and narrowing things down because it was limiting people who wanted to fly, you know, even the toy drones and the toy helicopters, because our laws at the beginning, some of them even apply to those smaller types. So we waited it out. And then in the past few years, We noticed that Canada had settled on some laws and we're probably going to hold pattern for a little while. So that's when we jumped in, and we had a great lands department that wanted to get in and start utilizing drones again. So we started off with, I believe, three members that went off and quickly got their pilot's license for drones. And then we looked at expanding it from there. So we actually have a large class currently working with Jacob at the moment, and I believe we have 10 to 15 members that are going through this, and eventually we're going to expand it to a full-fledged drone department, flying everything from the smaller unrestricted drones to the larger, more dedicated drones.
Well, that all sounds really exciting, Elton, and appreciate you joining the conversation. I'm going to move now to Shelley Knight, a cyber infrastructure facilitator with the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. And Shelley, hello again. And one of the challenges that we had when putting this show together is that there isn't a whole lot of research about tribal sovereignty in the context of airspace. But you, interestingly enough, wrote a master's thesis on the topic. What drew you to the concept?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show first. It's nice to be here. I had such great teachers. Let's just start with that, right? Teachers are so important, and they really help give me a foundation for understanding tribal sovereignty to begin with. Doctors Milo Vicente Carpio, David Martinez, and Dr. Ridingen at Arizona State, they really inspired me to kind of find, you know, tribal airspace sovereignty. It's since time immemorial, but how do we expand our understanding of it? That's important. You know, how do we get the federal government to understand this bigger perspective? So, you know, once they provoked me with those questions, I thought about, we're learning about water rights. Well, what about air rights? There was already some literature out there from attorney William Haney, some incredible work he did talking about this issue. And I just really wanted to kind of build off of that with some of the contemporary issues I was learning about in my classes and that were going on at the time. They inspired me. They helped me kind of look to and center a lot of indigenous scholars like Vine Deloria, David Wilkins. They set such a foundation for talking about and arguing on behalf of tribal sovereignty. So I had really great, there's already great scholarship out there to work from, though air law, you know, scholarship, particularly on air law, pertaining to Indian country might have been lacking, but there's already quite a bit to work with in that sense. So, yeah.
Well, what are some key takeaways from your thesis?
Yeah, so I think the major thing is, you know, looking and also applying water laws to understanding where there may be a legal foundation for talking about air laws. That was really helpful to tell, you know, federal government agencies like FAA, even EPA, you know, that there really is a good foundation in American jurisprudence to recognize that there are reserved rights for tribes in airspace, from the treaties, from Winter's doctrine relating to water rights, you know, there are reserved rights. So really, you know, they should be implying those rights are there, even though they're not yet written, and that they need to, you know, recognize them, that there needs to be really good consultation efforts. So I include two case studies in my thesis, one with No DAFL movement, and then the other one with the noise reduction consultation efforts with the tribes in the Grand Canyon area. And both, I think, really show how the U.S. federal government has the ability to consult with tribes, but also there are times, like with No DAFL movement, that they show they had, you know, previously they had the capacity, but then in that instance, they're not doing their, you know, with their trust ship with the tribes, they're not doing a good job. They need to, one of the things was like poor consultation looks like taking action too soon, too late, or not at all. And I think that case study really showed, you know, where the federal government can kind of pick and choose sometimes, and we need to hold them accountable.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that DAPL case study. What exactly was the situation there with the skies and how they related to DAPL?
Yeah, so I think you see the FAA kind of prioritizing the rights of private companies and the security company over the concerns of the tribal citizens who are there, and also the nations involved with a lot of things at stake. And I think that was just the biggest thing, you know, that it reveals that the FAA can sometimes, their priorities aren't where they should be. And yeah.
Got it. Shelley, it's interesting mm-hmm. that you were actually able to cite Vindaloria Jr. in this thesis. Tell me a little bit more about that sighting and how he's connected to this, because his name goes way back, you know, to the books that he wrote, you know, more than 50 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you know, their scholarship is just incredible, and they really help lay the foundation for understanding, you know, the importance of treaties as the law of the land and really containing reserved rights. And I think that's a great starting point to see, you know, air rights, again, need to see that tribes have rights in these spaces. Maybe, you know, tribal governments haven't been thinking of them like early on in a legal sense, but you know, tribal nations have always had a connection to airspace, have always had a, you know, it's part of, I think for many would agree, part of that holy place, like their connection to it. In particular, I thought there was a really interesting idea here about like legal standing, that in American federal Indian law and policy, there isn't much legal standing for natural resources, but to natives and indigenous peoples, like there is that legal standing.
Absolutely. We're going to have to take a short break. I'm sorry, but we'll be right back.
Pursuing a degree in higher education is attainable, and with a scholarship from Native Forward Scholars Fund, it is more affordable. From aerospace to veterinary medicine, as the largest direct scholarship provider to Native students in the U.S., Native Forward has empowered over 22,000 students from over 500 tribes in all 50 states in pursuit of their undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees. Info and applications at nativeforward.org. Who support this show.
You are listening to Native America Calling, and there's still a little bit of time to join our conversation about tribal airspace and sovereignty. Give us a call. Questions and comments are available and able to be directed to our guests at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And our next guest, Jonathan Cordova, student at the University of Montana. And Jonathan, welcome to our show again. And you're a geography student, and you've compiled research as well with regard to our topic today. What have you come across in your work?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. And yeah, well, as a geography student, they've kind of let me loose and explore different areas. So with tribal airspace, a lot of my research has come from Shelley Knight's research and the resources that she compiled. And yeah, a lot of it is that right now the FAA is still saying that they control all the airspace, and as far as like the industry, they want that to stay in that way because they don't want to create what they say what they would call a patchwork of different airspaces or different jurisdictions. So I would say they see that patchwork of airspaces as a hurdle to overcome, and again trying to get community acceptance with drones. I think that's where the standing right now with drones and community and industry is at, because right there the industry still doing testing. Amazon Air is still not able to deliver packages through drone. But that is, you know, going to be accelerating this year and within the next few years. So then, right now it's a good time because everything's still pretty early on as far as all that, as the drones are concerned. So then it's a good time to be having this conversation as far as tribal airspace and, my fellow guests have said, how tribes are sovereign and really asserting that right in the air.
Well, John, we heard Shelley earlier talk about the DAPL case study, and I know you contributed some of that data as well. And specifically, there was a censorship of drone photography during the No DAPL movement. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so with that, the FAA issued a temporary flight restriction that partially covered tribal land. So that was at the request of local police and security. But even prior to the FAA issuing that temporary flight restriction, you know, local police and security were already starting to regulate the airspace by shooting the drones with rubber bullets and all that. So then, but the main concern with the TFR, right, is that the TFR fell over tribal land. So then there was no consultation with the tribe there. And that's kind of where there's a disconnect between what the FAA says their interactions with tribes should be and what they actually end up doing.
Okay. Now, John, I understand in addition to all your research, you're also a drone pilot. And from somebody who actually flies drones and has that experience, what is it that we as listeners really need to understand about this issue in addition to the sovereignty and who controls the skies? Just for somebody who flies drones, how does it all fit together in this conversation?
Yeah, I would say that, in the next few years, you know, the airspace is going to be a lot more congested with different services being done through drones. So I would say that airspace awareness is going to be a huge component of being able to regulate and mitigate any sort of any bad actors that are using drones in that sense. So part of my work that I do here at the University of Montana is we do a tethered drone security for the football games. So right now it's just providing a live video feed to event managers, event coordinators, so they can put assets where they deem necessary. But a big component for stadiums as well is also, you know, countering a drone threat or countering some sort of activity like that. So, yeah, I would say that airspace management and that coordination is going to be very important going in the future.
Okay. Yeah, this sounds it sounds really exciting, but also really futuristic when you mentioned drone threats and what it would take to respond to a drone threat. So, really interesting conversation with Jonathan Cordova, one of our guests today. He's a student at the University of Montana. And I'm going to introduce now one more guest. We just got him on the line. His name is Robert Gifford. And he's in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. He is a Native American law attorney and also a tribal court judge. He's a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Hello, Robert, and welcome back to our show.
Thank you very much. Great to be back.
Great to have you. And so let's talk a little bit about the law here, because I think some of us are still a little confused in terms of, you know, what tribes can and cannot do with regard to regulating their skies.
Well, the tribes, and just like any other private party, a private person, you know, within, say, a state's jurisdiction or even any specific state, they do have a right up to a certain height in which they still own that airspace. Now, it's very limited. The FAA generally controls airspace. However, at a certain point, a private individual or, say, a tribal government or state government can impose some regulation on that. And mostly we think about drones in that aspect or other low-flying aircraft. But the FAA kind of sets the boundaries on that. And I believe in, I think, If I recall correctly, that in the cities and in the large metropolitan areas, it is the FAA has everything 500 feet above the tallest structure or the tallest building in that city. In the rural areas, the FAA looks to 360 feet above the tallest structure. So in the more rural areas, such as outside of a major city, it's a lower plane or a lower deck. But below that, that would be the rights of a private individual or a government, such as a tribal government or a state government. And they can impose those regulations on restrictions on drone flight and other low-flying aircraft for a private individual, you know, if it interferes with their privacy or it interferes with something in their livelihood or in their home. They also have a right, a private right, in which they can impose against whoever has that aircraft, which would include a drone.
Robert, we keep hearing about the FAA as, you know, maintaining or asserting its control of the skies. Are they the end-all be-all with regard to control and regulation of airspace?
They are within the continental United States. Outside of the United States, you know, each country would have their own organizing body. However, the FAA really kind of leads the way, and a lot of other countries may follow their lead. But at a certain point, even the FAA can't call that as well. It actually goes into sort of an international airspace, such as a ship or other vessel in the water, you know, right offside of the United States. It's, you know, it's within the United States boundary, but at a certain point, it falls within international waters. The same thing occurs here with airspace as well. And that's where we're starting to talk at a pretty great height, but that's when we're starting to talk more about international treaties and agreements between countries of, you know, of that itself.
Okay, because, yeah, I'm thinking at some point we're just going to hit space, and then the FAA is not going to have any authority there, I would hope.
Correct. And that's where, you know, a lot of people don't even realize this, but the United States has a treaty with the moon, you know, with other countries, establishing that no one country has ownership of the moon. And so there are these international laws and treaties between the countries when it comes to that that grade of distance. But when we're talking continental United States, you know, within, say, 30,000 feet or higher, in which an aircraft may normally fly, that's where the FAA is setting the regulations at.
All right. Let's take a caller, Theodora, who is listening in Mandaree, North Dakota on KMHA. Hello, Theodora, and thank you for calling today.
Yes, thank you for holding this this program on airspace.
You bet, Theodora. Tell us more about what you see up there in North Dakota.
Yes, I wanted to say that I listened to most of what your speakers talked about, and on Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, most of the land is owned by the individual tribal members, not by the tribal council. So, you know, we also have airspace rights over our property. And I haven't heard any of your speakers reference that, but so I'm calling in just to remind you of that, and that it would be good to know where people can contact in regards to this issue about you know, it's a coming up issue. So who are the decision makers on this, and how would an individual tribal landowner with airspace rights, where would they go in the federal system? Thank you.
All right, Theodora, that is a really, really good question. And thank you for keeping us on point. Robert, I think you're the person to answer this question. Theodora mentions there, where she lives, a lot of the land there, it's not tribally owned, it's privately owned land. How do some of these policies and these sovereignty issues apply to airspace over, you know, an individual tribal member's land that's privately owned?
Yes, and I did make a brief mention that there is individual right over the airspace, over their specific property and home. So while it is, you know, not as well-known or populated, you know, an individual has a right to do something about it as well. So for the first step, if there is an issue, you know, obviously the first call would be to the FAA to see if it regulates that part of the airspace. If it is something lower, and let's just say like a drone is flying over someone's backyard and basically harassing that individual, you know, the first step would be basically, you know, contact local law enforcement. The law enforcement would be required to investigate it to see if they could identify, and I'm just using drone as an example, to identify it. Number two, if local law enforcement can identify it, they should take it up to the next level and reach out to a federal law enforcement investigative authority about an unknown drone or other aircraft basically harassing or invading the space of an individual. Once that's identified, you know, basically it'd be treated like a trespass. You know, tell them you can't do that. If you do that, that would be trespassing. If there's a violation of privacy, that would be something, depending on whether the statute, whether it's a state statute, a tribal statute, or federal statute, could be enforced criminally. There would also be a private right to enforce as well, such as a civil, like a civil lawsuit for basically trespassing. And again, that would depend on the jurisdiction. And again, okay, if it's a tribal member, you know, within the reservation, you know, they could actually file a lawsuit if they can identify the owner of the aircraft.
Okay. I think this is all good, helpful information here, Robert. But you know what? I'm just envisioning somebody, like, I've got relatives like this, okay? I have relatives like this, and they wouldn't bother calling the FAA. They wouldn't call the cops. You know what they do? They'd go out in their front porch with a shotgun, and they'd bring that drone down. What are the legal ramifications of taking an action like that? I'm just curious.
Yeah. No, and actually, you know, I was thinking about that as well. And there, one of the concerns on doing that by basically taking the law in your own hand, again, there's no personal threat to an individual where an individual could be, you know, could be injured or lose their life. We're just talking about property in this aspect. The only concern in doing that by taking action in your own hands is if that was a drone that is owned and operated by a federal agency or something like that. But so before you would take action, I'd probably want to do some further investigation before you, you know, go after, say, some drone. They may be passing over your property as a part of a law enforcement investigation elsewhere. And if you interfere with that, you can see where the next step is, you know, all of a sudden your relatives or any individual by taking the law in their own hands could be having to defend themselves against the government, either by a lawsuit or by a criminal charge for destruction of property. So again, if it turns out it's another private individual and they're just flying and harassing you, flying in your airspace and somebody shot it down, then that kind of comes along with trespass. You know, it's a loss of property, and I think I would want to investigate it before I, pull out a gun and start shooting down a drone. But if it's a private person's drone and they're just, trespassing on the property, and if the removal causes destruction, then that's what happens. But I'd be very cautious without investigating it in the event that is a government owned aerial device, whether it's tribal, federal, state. You don't want to destroy it without at least making sure.
Okay, thank you for that information, Robert. I want to go back to Jacob Taylor with Indigenous Aerospace. Jacob, I want to give you the last word here. We've got about a minute before we have to wrap up the show. Any other information you want to share or insights you want to make regarding today's show topic, the skies and sovereignty and how they are connected?
Yeah, I hope this has been a light bulb moment for a lot of listeners, that there's no treaty signed for the sky. It motivates more people to join Elton, Shelley, Jonathan, Robert, myself, and, helping to assert sovereignty over skies for tribal peoples, for First Peoples. And, we're running out of land in our major metropolises. They're taking to the sky with air parcel sales and things as far as developers are going. And sorry, I'm getting an emergency alert here on my phone in Canada. Testing our public alert system. Okay, there it goes. As far as the settler folks at the FAA or in our Transport Canada Navigation side here on the northern side of the Medicine Line, like people like Elton, they need to have delegated officials that are empowered to enforce the current drone regulations, and we also need to be empowered to build our capacity to have our own tribal jurisdictions surrounding airspace. And so, last piece, too, if those folks are listening, I hope they start considering a back payment for all this air traffic to help Indian country, to develop in the modern capital landscape. So thanks for listening and look forward to next time.
All right. Well, Jacob, you remembered all of our guest names. You'd make a good radio show host, brother. Right. All right. Well, to Jacob Taylor, Elton Taylor, Jonathan Cordova, Shelley Knight, and Robert Gifford, thank you all for joining us. Wonderful conversation. We are going to have to wrap up the show now. Please, listeners, join us again tomorrow. We'll be having a discussion with the newly crowned Miss Indian World. Her name is Cassie John. Don't miss it. I'm your host, Sean Spruce.
Support for this program provided by Vision Maker Media, who envisions a world changed and healed by understanding Native stories and the public conversations they generate, nurturing the next generation of storytellers with courage, generosity, creativity, respect, and commitment. 45-plus years of Native stories and Indigenous knowledge through film and media can be found at visionmakermedia.org, whose slogan is, "Together, we are vision makers."
Tash, Pomso would urge that observe what sub task from a task or him, or go hina, my pasture in a boy away hit. I thought him warm to mop sap or cockshot. I know all her a marketplace how witcher, a mom milk would worse I took up. I'm by Chichus Machim, I'm my haggle got a mama came up bum ya, or my hachuka, I'm healthcare.gov, or my haggle got, I'm homoco, gigic, sicker, white homoco, gigic, gog, with us, homoco, eat up 100 hemoc centers for Medicare, Chmedicate, Hachipka.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.